At about 10 minutes past 8 yesterday morning, James Ogden and James Sutherland were hung in the government jail and went to meet that future into which human eyes cannot look. Their bearing throughout the short though harassing movements which preceded the fatal drop was quiet and undemonstrative. Their general manner was very different from the false hilarity so frequently assumed at the time of their apprehension and during the various stages of their judicial trial. They were brought out to the gallows yard, accompanied by the Reverend Mr. Shoebridge, who prayed for them most fervently as they went over the gangway to the black and dismal-looking gibbet. They seemed to move mechanically, just as directed. The only active signs of emotion were a nervous twitching of Sutherland's fingers and the trembling of Ogden's hands. In Ogden's right hand, there was a small bunch of flowers which remained in his grasp after death. That was a report in the Hobart Mercury on the 5th of June 1883, describing the final moments of Tasmanian bushrangers James Sutherland and James Ogden. Ogden was 20 and Sutherland was just 18 years old when they were executed for double murder, among other crimes. They were labelled as Tasmania's answer to Ned Kelly, and in fact when they were caught, they sang Kelly gang ballads in their cells. But what drove them into a life of crime? Let's find out in today's episode of Ratbags and Roustabouts, the place where we hear those extraordinary stories of ordinary people from history. I'm your host, Marion Langford. If I was to stop anyone on the street and ask them to name an Australian bushranger, chances are pretty good most would say Ned Kelly. He's certainly the most famous bushranger from Australian history, with books and films and songs and paintings and museum exhibits, and even the Kelly Land Glen Rowan tourist attraction in Victoria, which reenacts the Kelly gang's last stand. Some people see Ned Kelly as a hero, others denounce him as a villain, but whichever way your opinion of him leans, he has without a doubt been immortalised in the Australian lexicon. But what you might not realise is that the Kelly gang has pretty much been idolised in that way from not long after young Ned looked at that metal board on a plough and thought, I bet I can make a suit of armour out of that. In fact, the Ballad of the Kelly Gang, a song which details the bold pursuits of the outlaws, was written in 1879. It's actually rumoured that Kelly gang member Joe Byrne penned it himself. Byrne died the following year from a fatal gunshot during the siege of Glen Rowan when Ned Kelly was captured. Ned was then executed on the 11th of November 1880, and every Aussie kid for the next century or so was taught that his last words were, "Such is life." Though apparently that's not true, and his actual final words were, "Ah, well, I suppose it has come to this." Anyway, I'm not here to talk about Ned Kelly, because while we love a bushranger here on Ratbags and Roustabouts, we love the lesser-known bushrangers, and Ned Kelly is just way too well-known for our liking. But the point I'm making is that the Kelly gang was big news in the late 1870s and into 1880, which is when the two anti-heroes of today's episode, James Sutherland and James Ogden, were impressionable youths living fairly miserable lives in the wilds of Tasmania. And for the pair of teenage boys, tales of Ned Kelly sticking it to the man provided a small sliver of sunlight in an otherwise bleak existence. James Sutherland in particular had a horrendous childhood. He was born James Saunders sometime around 1865 near Ouse in the central highlands of Tassie. There isn't much information about his family. There's a report from 1883 that described his character and said that he often cried about his dead mother. The same article mentions talk of him having a sister who'd moved to Victoria and was also dead. We do know, however, that when James was 18 months old, his father gave him to a woman in Perth, Tasmania, to look after him. He lived with her until the age of five, and it was she who changed his name to James Sutherland. At 5 years old, again, he was given over to another woman at Evandale near Launceston for her to look after him, and he was there until the age of 11. At that point, he was turfed out of the house and told he could look after himself. So he tried to make his way back to Perth. That's when he was arrested for vagrancy and sentenced to 3 months in prison. After being released, he managed to get down to Hobart, where he worked for 6 months at Webb's Hotel, which is now Hadley's Hotel for anyone familiar with Hobart. Now, it's unclear what happened in the intervening time, but around the age of 15, a Sergeant Dewey comes across him. He's just run away from somewhere. He's in a miserable state. So the sergeant takes him to the police station at Kangaroo Point, which is now the suburb of Belrive, and fed him. Sutherland told Sergeant Dewey he had no parents, no friends, and nowhere to go. So it seems the sergeant found Walter Pedder, who gave him a job as a farm labourer. He did okay there for a while. He was pretty good at looking after the sheep and cattle and horses. But after some months, he decided he wanted to change again. So he got supplies, he got a boat, and he set off up the Derwent River. He sailed about 5 kilometres, then set the boat adrift and set off into the bush. Pedder didn't hear any more from him, so assumed he'd drowned, but of course he hadn't, and he turned up back at Pedder's farm 3 months later when he was given his old job back. Again, for a while, he did okay. He was a good worker, he was earning decent money, he even met a girl he wanted to marry once he had enough savings. But that's when he fell in with the wrong crowd. He became friendly with a couple of disreputable young guys who convinced him to leave the farm and, as the paper described, lead a roving life. There's another report that said he left to try his luck at mining. Gold was discovered in various parts of Tasmania, spanning many years from the late 1840s, but considering where Sutherland ended up, it's likely he went up to Lyell, not far from Launceston, where gold was found in 1878. There isn't much known of his life from that point, but if he did travel to Lyell, it would have put him in a good position to meet his friend and co-conspirator, James Ogden. We don't have such a clear picture of James Ogden's upbringing, though it was certainly more settled than James Sutherland. But perhaps that was actually his downfall, because while he had a roof over his head, his family apparently didn't provide the best role models for young James. He was born in Brighton, north of Hobart, on October 31st, 1863, to parents Thomas and Anne. And from birth records, I've managed to count at least 5 children in the family, though there may have been more. The family moved around quite a lot. I don't think any of the children were born in the same place. They began on the wharves in Hobart, then moved to New Norfolk, then Brighton when James was born, then up to Launceston, then Westbury, just west of Launceston. At the time he and Sutherland turned outlaw in Epping Forest, he was living with his mother only a couple of kilometres away from the scene of his first crime. The Devon Herald gave a bit of a profile of the two bushrangers, and this is what it said about Ogden. Ogden, by far the weaker of the two, both in intellect and physical strength, appears to have been the dupe of others beside his mate since he began a wandering life. Like Sutherland, he was left early to his own resources, though he had a home above his head for a somewhat lengthened period. Still, what was this when it is borne in mind that vice was prevalent there? The vice it might be alluding to there was Ogden's older brother, William, better known as Dido, better known as Donkey Bill. In August 1879, there'd been some robberies taking place in Epping Forest on the road to the Lyell goldfields by 2 men. The papers called these sticking up cases, which I guess you could equate these days to muggings or highway robbery. Essentially, it was bushranging activity, and it got the community very worried. You have to bear in mind that in Tassie, bushrangers weren't as common at the end of the 1800s as they had been nearer the beginning. The last convicts to be transported to Tasmania arrived in 1853, and largely those early Tasmanian outlaws were what was called bolters, convicts who'd literally bolted from where they were meant to be, because they preferred to risk the dangers and hardships of living in the bush than to live under the convict yoke. But people still remembered the fear and the violence of the bushrangers, and so they got more than a little twitchy if any popped up. Anyway, they didn't catch the two men, but the following year, Dido Ogden was caught and charged with robbing a man in Epping Forest. There was a bit of a cock-up when the principal witness failed to identify him and Dido walked. Of course, his brother wouldn't be quite so lucky. There's also another story about James Ogden told years later by a former schoolmaster called Theophilus Quested. He remembered him as a pupil at his school and said he often had to stop Ogden from trying to strangle or stab classmates who he fought with. It seems that Ogden was smaller, weaker, not as good looking, and not as smart as the younger Sutherland, but he was angry, and so was Sutherland. The same article summed up Sutherland, saying he had no mother's love nor father's wisdom to direct his passage through life. They were two boys cast adrift in an unforgiving, brutal, uncaring world. And so they drifted towards each other and decided it was time for a little payback. So let's take a look at their crimes. On the night of April 9th, 1883, at a property at Epping Forest, railway line labourer William Wilson and his wife Teresa were in bed asleep. Elsewhere in the house were their three sons and one daughter, as well as another woman, Mary Boreham. She was a widow on her way to take up employment in New Norfolk and was just stopping the night at the Wilsons' home before continuing her journey. So they're all asleep when they hear a noise that sounds like stones falling on the roof. At first, William thought the dogs might be loose, so he gets up and goes outside to have a look. He finds nothing, so he goes back to bed. But a few minutes later, it happens again, the sound of stones hitting the roof. He says, "There must be someone there." His wife Teresa says to him, "Don't go out there, Bill," but he goes out anyway. And this time, he doesn't come back. Teresa hears a strange voice and then a gunshot. She runs outside as her husband staggers up to her, telling her, "Oh, Tris, I'm shot." He's holding a hand up to his face. Teresa then begins calling out for help, but her husband says to her, "No one is going to hear you. They will kill you." He then makes her go back inside the house and lock the door behind her before he then collapses on the ground outside the bedroom window. Stones continue to hit the roof and then something worse. A voice calls out through the darkness, "Mistress, come out. We'll give you three times, and if you don't come out, we'll lay you down alongside where he's lying." Teresa doesn't say anything back. Sutherland and Ogden then begin throwing stones to smash the windows. The stones are hitting the bed. They try forcing open the door. Then a shot comes through the window, and finally a voice says, "Come on, Kelly, we'll set fire to the bloody place." Now, because of their love for the Kelly gang, during the attack, Sutherland was using the alias Jim Kelly, and Ogden was calling himself Dan Riley. The terrified women and children inside the hut could hear wood being put up against the house. Even their cart was moved up against a wall. And then they set it on fire. Smoke begins billowing inside the house. Flames are licking the bed. Teresa gathers the children and the guest, Mary Boreham, and as the smoke grows thicker. Finally, they have no choice but to go outside the burning building. Mary, as she steps out, is trying to carry a child in one arm and a box in the other arm. Meanwhile, she doesn't realise, but the bushrangers have taken away the step, and so she falls as she comes out the door. That's when Sutherland shoots her. She cries out, "My God, I'm shot." She goes up to the bushranger, offering him 4 half-crowns, begging him not to shoot her again and begging him to spare the children. Teresa also runs up to Sutherland, saying, "Please, spare me to my children." At this point, Sutherland was all bravado. He was very cocky, seemed in his element. He starts to roll his gun in his hand, takes the time to introduce himself, tries to convince Teresa that there's a whole gang of attackers hidden around the dark bush. This is what he actually said to her. "Well, my name is Jim Kelly and my mate's name is Dan Riley, and recollect there is 2 or 3 more of us hanging back." Meanwhile, the children, they begin running towards the neighbour's place, which was about 1/2 kilometre away. Mary Borum too, who is now seriously hurt, is half crawling, half dragging herself along the ground, gets herself through a hole in the fence, goes across the railway in the same direction as the children. Sutherland allows this until he sees the girl, 11-year-old Lizzie. He calls her back. Pointing at Ogden, he says, "Do you know that fellow standing there?" "Yes, that's Jim Ogden," she replies. It was not the right answer to give. He grabs her by the shoulder and he and Ogden drag her off up the road. Teresa runs after them, trying to get her daughter back, but Sutherland turns, holds the gun to her heart and says he'll shoot her if she doesn't go back. Reluctantly, she runs off to the neighbour's house as well. But the men at the neighbour's house are scared. They refuse to go back with her and she's left terrified about what may have happened to her daughter. Meanwhile, Sutherland and Ogden were holding Lizzie captive in the bush. At first, they planned to kill her. They seemed very adamant on sticking to these aliases, and being recognised by a young girl wasn't part of the plan. But they later said they didn't have the heart to harm her as she was a sweet kid. So, telling her to make sure she used their aliases, they let her go and she ran off to where her brothers were. But she wasn't the only person that night who recognised Jim Ogden. Mary Borum recognised him. She said many's the bit of bread she had given him over the years. Teresa also recognised him. She'd visited his mother several times, and she didn't know of any ill feeling between James Ogden and her husband. In fact, the only motive for the attack on the Wilson family that anyone could fathom was that James Ogden believed William Wilson had come between him and a girl that he liked. William Wilson died from his wounds, but Mary Borum survived. The scene at the house the following day was described in the Launceston Examiner. "The scene in the morning was one of a most harrowing description. The first object that attracted the attention of the visitor to the spot was the smouldering ruins of what but a few hours before had been a happy homestead. Stretched a short distance away was the body of Wilson, who from all appearances was a stalwart man in the prime of life at the time when he fell a victim to the horrible wantonness of the fiends in human form, who, to satiate their craving for notoriety, brought one who had never harmed them to an untimely end. Pacing to and fro near the corpse of her murdered husband could be seen the almost frantic wife bemoaning the sad fate of her protector and at times evidently endeavouring to realise that the proceedings of the previous night were after all but a hideous dream." It's unclear when or how Ogden and Sutherland became friends, but we can trace their steps a bit in the days leading up to the killing of Wilson. On midnight, 2 days before the attack, the pair went to the police station in Launceston, where Ogden made a complaint that he'd had 12 shillings stolen from him by a woman in a brothel. The sergeant told him to come back Monday morning, which he said he would. Then the following day, the pair visited the Woolpack Inn at Breadalbane, about 12 kilometres south of Launceston. The landlord said he'd heard them talking about going down to Campbelltown. Apparently, Sutherland was heard talking about going after some dogs and traps they'd lost, saying he'll hear more about it. Ogden then said, "We'll put the bloody wretches through before we come back." That evening, they were seen by a man called John Pryor. He knew them both. He saw them camping at his place at Simmons Plains, about 14 kilometres north of Epping Forest. They didn't have a gun when he saw them arrive, but he owned a single-barrel shotgun, which he kept in his hut. They had this when they left the following morning, and it was this gun that was used to kill Wilson. But before they were captured, they would commit murder another time. Sutherland and Ogden had attacked the Wilson house on the night of the 9th and the morning of the 10th of April. On the 11th, they killed again with no apparent reason. Coachman Alfred Holman was driving a lemonade cart along the road from Hobart back to Launceston that day. It was a trip the 47-year-old often made. But not far after passing through Epping Forest, he encountered Sutherland and Ogden, and he would not survive the meeting. No one knows how he was approached or what was said between Holman and the bushrangers. But not long afterwards, Harold Archer was riding on horseback along the main road travelling south from Longford. He was near Fairfield, about 3 kilometres north of Epping Forest, when he saw Alfred Holman lying on the road, who he at first took to be a bit tipsy. He stopped thinking he'll just move him off the road, when Holman raises his head and says to him, "Help, I'm shot." Archer said to him that he'd go get help. At that time, Holman appeared to be holding his side, but there were no wounds visible to his head or face. That would change. Archer had heard about what had happened in the Wilson house a couple of days previously, so he galloped to Epping to tell the police there about Holman. Meanwhile, Thomas Rice, a labourer at Bellevue near Epping Forest, heard from someone that Ogden and another man had been spotted playing cards a couple of miles away. So he and another man rode off to search for the pair, and that's when they also found blood and human hair on the road and then discovered Holman, this time lying under a log. He was still alive, but barely. He was covered in blood, and he now also had his skull fractured and he'd been scalped. Holman managed to ask for water. By now, some other men who were out searching for Sutherland and Ogden, including a police constable, had joined the group. One of them goes off to get water. At the same time, a local coachman, James Smith, heard that a man had been found on the road, and he went to see if he could help. When he got to the scene, he recognised Holman. He was friends with him, and Holman was there, covered in blood, gasping for breath. He died about 2 minutes later. Smith knew Holman would have been driving his lemonade cart, so four of the men, Smith, Curran, Flood, and Constable Phillips, went off in search for it. Following the cart's tracks, they eventually found it twisted and damaged some way into the bush. And they also found Ogden and Sutherland helping themselves to the lemonade in the back of the cart. Smith whispered, "Shall I shoot them?" He was holding a loaded double-barrel shotgun. Phillips whispered back, "No, don't shoot." Phillips then stood up, holding his gun on the men, and said, "Put your arms up." Sutherland and Ogden immediately bolted through the bush. The four men gave chase. They kept calling out to the bushrangers to give themselves up, but Sutherland and Ogden ignored them, so Phillips and Smith both fired at them but missed. But the shots were enough to scare the bushrangers into stopping. They put up their arms and Phillips handcuffed them and led them away. When the men were searched, the constable found a watch on Ogden which had been in a parcel that Holman was bringing back from Hobart for a local man. And later at Epping Station, when the police were trying to work out why the outlaws had targeted Holman, Sutherland said that about 4 months previous, he'd happened upon Holman coming along the road and asked him for a lift, which Holman had refused. When the police inspector said to Sutherland, "Holman was my friend," Sutherland began laughing back, saying, "You should have seen him tumble off that there box. It was a bloody caution. He has a rare dollop in him. The old gun had a fistful of shot in her." It seems that Sutherland and Ogden had been stopped in the bush not far from the main road at Fairfield, playing cards and smoking, when they saw Holman passing. Possibly remembering the wrong Sutherland thought Holman had done him, they went to the road and shot Holman, the blast forceful enough to knock him off the cart. They then took the cart some way into the bush and began searching it for any valuables. At that point, Archer had discovered Holman and galloped off to get help. It's possible the bushrangers heard this and wanted to make sure Holman couldn't identify them, so they went back, bashed in his head, maybe with a rock or just on the road, and scalped him. Both of these crimes were shocking in their violence and brutality. They were fueled by anger and a feeling of injustice. And the motives, the personal vendettas against Wilson and Holman, were small irritations. They weren't deserving of the type of payback Sutherland and Ogden dealt out. At the same time, they attacked people they had been a passing acquaintance with, yet tried to hide their identities with their Kelly-styled aliases. But there was no blaze of glory like their beloved Kelly gang. There was no shooting at police, no bank robberies, no armour, no siege at a pub, no last stand. They were simply fired at a couple of times by one constable and they threw down their gun. The Devon Herald said this: "Looking at the details of the crimes, there seems to have dwelt within them at the time a spontaneous longing for notoriety, rather than foul intent. They wanted to be famous or infamous, but they went about it in a horrifically violent way. At their trial for the double murder of William Wilson and Alfred Holman, a barrage of people piled in and out of the witness box. The court even took a field trip to Mary Boreham's hospital bed to take her statement. Their defence lawyer, Andrew Inglis Clark, had no witnesses to call for the defence. He instead tried to use an insanity plea. The Launceston Examiner reported this: Clark said an irrational, motiveless crime was proof of insanity, and such was the case with the prisoners in the present instances. He said the minds of the prisoners had been worked upon by reading the acts of the Kelly gang in Victoria, till they looked upon their deeds as heroic and brave. Clark essentially argued that Sutherland's pride in the pair's actions and his bravado proved that he was insane. After hearing all the evidence and statements, the jury was then sent out to consider their verdict. 37 minutes later, the foreman read out their finding that Sutherland and Ogden were guilty of willful murder, and he added that it was one of the clearest cases of murder he had ever heard of. So why did they do it? Fame? Anger? Was it really society's fault? Had the pair, Sutherland in particular, been failed by the cruel lot he'd been dealt in life? It's true he had a horrible childhood. He was barely an adult when he committed these crimes. But to be cast aside by every adult who had ever been charged with looking after him, to be expected to look after himself from the age of 11, to be thrown in jail as a youngster because he was homeless. In those days, of course, times were different to how they are now, but even then, people could see the cruelty of that upbringing. You can see how someone who has only had negativity from every adult they've ever come across could view a band of young men like the Kelly gang who are fighting injustice, or at least they claim they're fighting injustice, who are sticking it to the man, who are standing up and saying no. You can see how Ned Kelly could appear as a hero to two people like Sutherland and Ogden. But we can't blame it all on society. Ogden, he had a fairly stable home. There were friendly adults such as Mary Boreham giving him bits of bread when she saw him. Sutherland too eventually came across Walter Petter, who took him under his wing, gave him a job, food, money, a home. If he'd just stuck to that job, things could have been very different. Sutherland's apparent blasé attitude to the crimes as well almost upset people more than the actions themselves. After the pair's capture, their route to Campbelltown Jail took them past the burnt-out ruins of the Wilson House. That's when Sutherland looked at Ogden and said, "Here's a bloody sight, grand, isn't it?" Ogden didn't answer. Sutherland then said to the policeman with them, "He was a bloody old fool, you know. We did not mean to shoot him, only to have a lark with him and threw something on the house, and when he came out, if he had been civil, we would not have shot him. But when he came out and said, "You'd better be off, you bloody shaver," that's a word that means swindler, "whoever you are, or I'll put a charge of shot in you," it was time for me to look out, and I said, "Oh, through you," and I fired. He asked if the girl was okay, which the policeman answered, yes, she was. Sutherland then said, "I could not find my heart to murder the girl. I liked her." Then, after they'd been sentenced to death and they got to Hobart Jail, when Sutherland came to have his booking photograph taken, he's there posing with a pipe in his mouth, his back straight, shoulders back, chest puffed out, looking down the camera of the lens with a provoking, defiant stare. In another picture of the two of them, they're sitting close to each other, smiling for the camera. That kind of rebellious attitude continued right through from when they were captured all the way till they're awaiting their execution. Ogden was a bit quieter, more sensitive, but Sutherland was full of bluster. That is, until the end finally came. This is what it said in the Launceston Examiner. The prisoners James Sutherland and James Ogden, convicted of the murder of William Wilson and Alfred Holman at Epping Forest in April last, were executed this morning at the Campbell Street Jail. Neither of the prisoners had slept during the night, saying that they would see as much as they could of the world that was so soon to be left, and both softened in their demeanour during the night. This morning, Sutherland requested Mr. Mace to send to Mrs. Wilson and Mrs. Holman and ask them to forgive him. And he also spoke bitterly of the treatment he had received during his lifetime, saying the world had not been a pleasant one to him, that he had had no parents to look after him, but had been kicked about by those who got as much work as possible out of him without caring in the least about him. He also said he had thought a good deal more about his position than people had given him credit for. Both prisoners seemed to realise their position. Both men walked calmly along the bridge leading to the scaffold, Sutherland's step being as firm as ordinarily, while Ogden, who carried in his right hand a bunch of flowers sent to him through the Reverend Mr. Shoebridge by a little girl attending Trinity Church Sunday School, trembled violently, but otherwise made no sign. When the hangman placed the noose around Sutherland's neck, he pulled himself together, never flinching, Ogden also keeping firm, and the muscles of neither of their faces moved as the fatal cap was drawn over their heads. The bolt was drawn at 8:10 a.m., and side by side, the unfortunate lads were launched into eternity. Standing on the scaffold, they looked more boyish than ever, making it difficult to believe them the perpetrators of the deeds for which they justly suffered death. And that was that. The brief criminal career of Tasmania's answer to the Kelly Gang, James Sutherland and James Ogden. Incidentally, the hangman that day was Tasmania's most famous hangman, Solomon Blay. For anyone who has checked out my extra stories on the website, ratbagsandroustabouts.com, I wrote about him for episode 6, Gaffes at the Gallows. And actually, if you'd like to hear more about the times that executions have not gone according to plan in Australia, that's a really good episode to get across. Anyway, when Solomon Blay drew the bolt that day when Sutherland and Ogden were executed, it pushed his tally over the 100 mark. Blay was Australia's longest-serving hangman. Across the course of 50 years, he sent more than 200 prisoners off into oblivion. But that is that for today's episode. I hoped you liked getting back to a bit of good old Aussie bushranger business. Don't forget to head over to the website, ratbagsandroustabouts.com, to read all the show notes. On there, there's also links to some of the stories I used for my research. So if you're interested in reading all the court reports, which are quite fascinating, you'll be able to find the links there. And if you like your podcasts on YouTube, you can now find Ratbags and Roustabouts there as well. Plus, of course, don't forget you can follow me over on Instagram too. As usual, I'll be back in a fortnight's time for more stories of those common as muck ratbags and roustabouts from our past who still have incredible tales to tell.